This is Rage, Radio Against Global Ecocide. This week we have Shannon Walsh, writer and director of H2 Oil. Music by Filthy Politicians and Bombs. This is Rage, building a community of resistance one podcast at a time. Hello and welcome to a late edition of Rage, Radio Against Global Ecocide. Coming to you from occupied Amiskwatsibiskaigan, I am your host, Seymour Life. And a special hello to all the resistors and supporters of resistors out there. Keep up the good work. First, I would like to remind everyone that DGR is happening in Edmonton, and registration is open until March 24th. Today, we are speaking with H2 Oil's director and writer, Shannon Walsh. Shannon spreads her time between Canada and South Africa, bringing to light issues in both countries, especially pertaining to social justice. Welcome to the show, Shannon. How would you describe yourself?
Well, it's a hard question to describe myself, but I guess I'm a filmmaker, activist, writer, a whole range of stuff. And mainly what I do these days is make films and try to engage both doing education and writing a lot about the issues that I think are relevant to the times we live in.
What other things are you working on or have you done?
I've been involved in lots of different projects over the years, like that are pretty diverse. I just finished my PhD, for example, working on land and housing issues in South Africa, as well as HIV issues for a long time. I spent a good amount of time back and forth in South Africa over the last 8 years, so that's
right.
A big part of my life.
Right.
Here in Montreal, where I live as well, I've been involved in justice work. I made some films on solidarity across borders movement. So I kind of mix up making films and with kind of my interest in activism, I guess, over a long period of time now.
Cool. Yeah, I noticed that on the website that you do work in, so I kind of wanted to tie that in. It's like, okay,
yeah.
that's quite interesting. And I wasn't sure what you did in South Africa, so that's great
yeah.
to know.
Yeah. Yeah, I work a lot with activist groups there as well as social movements there.
For
me, it fits a lot together with what's happening here.
So H2 Oil, how did you come up with the idea? What made you decide to do it?
In a way, it was serendipitous, I think, the way that most good ideas are, that serendipitous in a slightly bad way. The topic is so heavy, but it was actually a couple of friends of mine who are in the film, Aaron and Kathy Mathers, who had started a business in Alberta. They were actually doing her family were doing a fresh water bottling business out there. With all the contradictions that entails, had started watching the water levels go down in Alberta and had absolutely nobody to turn to. So who they did turn to was some of their filmmaker friends to say, we don't understand what's going on, and if there's anyone protecting water in this province, can you come out and help us figure out the answer to those questions? And myself and the filmmaker Alan Cole, who ended up doing a lot of the cinematography and some of the direction on the film, went out there and sort of by accident actually understood what was the full implications of what was happening in the tar sands. And as soon as I learned about what was happening, it was a sort of no-brainer that from here on out, I had to pursue it to the ends and try and make a film about it. So it sort of started a little bit spontaneously.
So can you describe H2 Oil?
What the film's about.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think what I tried to do with the documentary was give both on the ground look that really follows some of the communities most affected. So the community of Fort Chipewyan, which is a First Nations community downstream of the industry, who've been facing a lot of the health impacts, lots of cancers, tons of deaths happening in their community, get up close to what's really going on there. What are they seeing in the land and environment mixed with the macro impacts of what is a project like the tar sands mean for Canada and really for the world at this point at the end of the age of oil, in my opinion. And so I try to put together both that kind of up close look at what people are facing with the bigger implications of what a project like this means.
Now, I've asked other people this question, and it's always interesting some of the answers you get, but what is it? Is it oil sands, tar sands, something else? Like, from your, like, now you've done a sort of, done a documentary on it, what would you say it really is?
Well, it's a really funny story, actually, because oil sands is a rebranding that was done by the oil industry to change the name of what had always been called the tar sands. I mean, it's not oil at all. It's this tar-like substance, bitumen, that really, you know, we're talking about an oil that's trapped in sand. So it's like tar, really. I mean, that's tar sands comes from that.
Right.
And it was a movement, a move that was made as part of a branding campaign by the industry, I guess in the last 20 years, that tried to sell it as oil sands because it actually evokes the image of oil. So a lot of the environmental groups have tried to recapture the original name, tar sands, what it's known as, what it's been known as, and what it's known as a lot around the world, and kind of take back that name. Myself personally, I feel like using a bit of both because it confuses people a bit. They think, are we talking about the same thing? And at the end of the day, what we're talking about is one of the largest, most destructive projects on the planet right now. And I think that's the thing that needs to stick in our mind much, much more than whether it's oil sands or tar sands.
If you had to say, okay, here's the three most important things you really need to know about the tar sands, about this, you know, destructive project, what would they be?
I think one of the most important things absolutely is that this is the largest industrial project on the planet, maybe ever. I mean, we're talking about the size of moving some of the same amounts of land as the Panama Canal, the Great Wall of China, all these projects combined.
Wow.
We're dealing with a huge, huge scale project here that spans across the continent of North America. But it also brings together, I think, in the second case, really the crisis that we're facing, both of capitalism and of the environment. I mean, we're looking at water shortages, and this is a project that uses vast amounts of water, creating a huge carbon impact. It's excesses to the nth degree at the level of the resources that we need to survive. Right at this moment, we're also facing a crisis of oil. So those kind of factors coming together to me are really critical. Yeah, I think that those are some of the key things you have to keep in mind, let alone the kind of environmental impacts on the forest, the water, and the carbon emissions.
Yeah, because I really liked at the end of the trailer anyway, there's a gentleman that you were talking to from Fort Chip, and he's basically saying, you know, we're always meddling with nature, and it just wants to be left alone. And I really liked that that clip. What kind of effect has it had on the boreal forest around there? Because I know there's, and maybe you can talk a little bit about the difference between the mining process and the SAGD process, and how that's been affecting the boreal forest in both cases.
Yeah, there's the mining process and the SAGD processes, different kinds of impacts, and sometimes the industry wants to give us an impression that, in a nutshell, like the mining process obviously scrapes away all of the boreal forest, but also the muskeg, the rivers, everything that's on the surface and digs into the ground in what looks very much like traditional mining, whereas the SAGD process puts pipes deep underground, and SAGD is steam-assisted gravity drainage. So they're pumping hot water heated by natural gas underground as well to heat up the bitumen that will then be collected and pumped up to the surface. Both are really environmentally devastating, and both have huge water impacts as well as natural gas impacts. They use both of those resources to get what is ultimately turned into crude oil, with all of the implications, carbon and otherwise, that come with that. But in terms of the boreal forest, I mean, one of the images I like to transmit, and I think it's one of the reasons I made the film, is because it's such a visual thing, is that the impacts on the boreal forest, what they're proposing to do encompasses about the size of Florida, of the state of Florida, of boreal forest and muskeg being removed from that region. And already when you fly over up there, the land is carved up with the leases that are being carved up by companies and the makeways for pipelines. And it actually looks like a grid work. You know, you fly over a city and you expect to see the streets marked out in a certain kind of grid-like function, but you fly over the boreal forest and you don't expect to see this kind of unbelievable regimentation of land, which is all ultimately marked for destruction if we fail to do anything about it.
And you've talked about water, and I've recently talked with Sheila Muxlow, who's the water campaigner for the Sierra Club.
Yeah.
And water is obviously a big issue in Alberta, and you touched on it. Water is actually the reason why you started doing this
Absolutely.
Whole process. Can you sort of go through some of the other issues around water with the tar sands?
Yeah. I mean, the processes themselves, because this isn't unlike what people imagine getting oil and the idea of oil sands, you think maybe this is easy to get, that you would actually be able to pump oil from the ground somehow, but actually to actually extract the oil from the sand takes an extremely large amount of fresh water and very pure water as well. It's not just any water that can do this. So the water that's being used is seen as between 3 to 5 barrels of fresh water for every barrel of oil that's extracted. And, and what happens is this water, they could never figure out how to get the oil out of the sand for a long time. And finally, they figured out what they should do is, what they could do was actually spin the water, very hot water, heated by natural gas as well as with some chemical compounds with fresh water, and the oil would rise to the top and separate from the water, and they could extract it. Well, it's still bitumen in that form. It still needs further refining.
Right.
But this is where the water comes in at that point. But then you're left with all of this dirty water. So that water then goes into these enormous toxic tailing ponds that are dotting the entire landscape of northern Alberta, some of them as large as 16 kilometers around.
Wow.
Absolutely enormous, and then leaking into the river. So again, the impacts on water is a real process. That river flows north. It flows into one of the largest freshwater deltas in the world, the Mackenzie River Delta, and also feeds into communities all over those downstream places, many First Nations communities like Fort Chipewyan that are seeing health impacts from the chemicals and toxins that are going into their water system on the animals.
Yeah, you have some very graphic pictures there of what it's doing to, you know, fish and some of the other animals. Can you talk more about the local community when you were in Fort Chipewyan and the overall feeling is about the community there?
I think Fort Chipewyan is a place that I think anyone who would go there would really feel the impact of a place like that. For me, I wasn't the one who cracked the story of Fort Chipewyan. I found out about the fact that both the local doctor there, some of the community members had already been raising the alarm, and I was intrigued and wanted to find out more about what they were facing. And what I found out was this unbelievably resilient community, the oldest community in Alberta, actually. Fort Chipewyan has a long history. It was a fur trading post. And, I mean, the Dene trace their roots back there to time immemorial, and as well as the Cree who've been there long. But, I mean, what really struck me, I think, going there was the stories and the links that the elders bring to the understanding of how we live in the world and how we live on the land.
Mm-hmm.
One of the first things we were asked to do when we came, even though it was obvious that we were coming with kind of, you know, trying to understand what they were putting out into about what their community was facing around this massive development, was to sit with elders and to listen to the elders. And to listen to what they told of their lives and what they'd seen, the changes they'd seen on the land, the changes they'd seen in the water, the changes that they had seen in the animal life and whatnot. And for me, that was such an amazing experience of also the transfer of knowledge and the understanding of our relationship to the world in which we live. I feel extremely thankful to that community. And for me, the film is absolutely a pledge to that community to support the struggle of not only Fort Chipewyan, but of Indigenous communities around this country and throughout the world who are at the front lines of facing environmental destruction and who are leading the fight for us on so many fronts and in so many ways.
It's a very moving story. And lately now there's been this whole issue about the ducks and the ducks dying. And at the same time you have, you know, the people in Fort Chip that are dying from this, and yet the ducks are getting the media, and I don't want to take away from the fact that, you know, the death of the ducks is very, very tragic and should not have happened either. And it just seems to me that the people that are being constantly marginalized by the whole issue, and then also I think the doctor who brought it up has been threatened and has had a lot of pressure against him, and to the point where he even left Alberta for a while.
I think Dr. O'Connor, who really was evoked by what, when he just tried to see say what he had seen, which was increasing rates of cancers and other autoimmune diseases happening in the community where he was practicing, and he was like completely silenced by the government, mm-hmm. and almost lost his job out of the process. It was extremely high pressure on him for a long time, and I think he said it quite well at a certain point. He said, you know, if the river flowed south into Calgary, would we have this kind of inattention to right. the fact that people are dying of cancers at this high rate for such a small community? And I think the Ducks example is excellent. George Poitras, who is a member of the Mikisew Cree First Nation and who has been a longtime activist around these issues, was one who really often would start using the Ducks as an example of the kind of systemic racism and the environmental mm-hmm. racism mm-hmm. that is so present around issues like this, because there's people in his community that chief after chief is trying to bring attention to the issue that their community is dying, and 500 ducks was the first count we heard. Now we hear 1,600, but mm-hmm. those ducks die, and the country is up in arms. The premier, you know, goes on record making comments. The prime minister makes a statement, and we have this entire political ruffle for ducks. And again, not to diminish it, but at the same time, it is really symptomatic of how deep that we're willing to look away from the impacts we have mm-hmm. On the Indigenous people in this country, but also in people in the global South who we expect to take the brunt of the devastation that we're doing to the planet. I'm really happy to see that St. Crude is in court nonetheless, and I hope that they get a good whip for the Ducks. You know, like, I've talked to people in Fort Chip who've told me, you know, 20 years ago, as long ago as that their job at the tailings ponds was to wring the necks of birds who had landed and died. I mean, this particular story about the 1,600 birds, there was a whistleblower there, and we heard about it. How many birds mm-hmm. have died on those ponds over the last decades that we've never heard about, that never came to light?
Yeah, and I'm sure that the elders probably gave a number of good stories about how the populations of ducks and moose and deer and things that have been diminishing in the area. Mm-hmm. And certainly, I think, at least I've heard stories that, you know, from people that say, you know, they used to go up in camps and do tramp lines and stuff, and then like 20 years and those are all gone. I mean, they're not even close, you know, not even close to being existing anymore. So
the moose are decreasing. You know, there's stories about muskrat, like one of the most disturbing that I've heard is like muskrats. The trap houses smelling of oil, like, and what, like having bleeding noses, animals with bleeding noses, all kinds of cysts being found on animals in the land. And what I think people don't understand that are so disrupted from a connection to both the food that you eat and the world, like the physical world in which you live, is that the disruption of finding tumors on your fish and finding that like the moose population is decreasing and the trap lines are, there seems to be sicknesses in the animals, like, you know, yellowed livers and whatnot, is that process of eating, hunting, being on the land, the time that you take out is so much part of what makes your culture, what makes your community. And in that way, it's not just like you just walk down to the northern store and you buy a tomato for $5 and it feels the same as it would if you provide for your family for the year with the hunt that you did during the hunting season.
Right.
It's a violence. It's a cultural violence that I think is really hard to perceive if you haven't spent any time or lived in a culture that really relies on hunting and fishing as part of their cultural identity. That's one of the things I think is one of the hardest parts to get across. You know, people are dying of cancers and autoimmune diseases and all these things, and that is totally traumatic. But people will open their freezer, and, you know, when I'm in Fort Chip, I eat dry fish and moose meat and stuff with everyone else, even though we've all sat in the community hall and listened to the studies that say the rising arsenic levels in the moose make them toxic. But it's sort of like, what do you do?
Yeah. Yeah. This is crazy.
Yeah. It really is. Yeah.
Yeah. What has the Suncor and the general response been to these studies and these statements that are saying this is what's happening to the fish, this is what's happening to the moose, this is what's happening? What has been sort of the standard response to that?
Well, it's funny. I'm like, I look at that a bit in the film and have some of the responses of government. And there's this sense that, I mean, science is, like everything else, riddled with opinions, you know? And we have an idea that science is this hard truth or whatnot, but often, I mean, one of the quite provocative reports that came out about the impacts that were happening based its findings on the government's own reports that had buried certain kinds of data in footnotes or in interpretations that looked at it slightly different. And I think there is, like, behind all that, and, you know, it was an interesting process to think, how does power work while I was making the film, and how do people convince themselves that things are fine? Because it's not like there's a bunch of, like, terrible, bad people sitting around deciding that we want to kill the indigenous community and we know what's happening. It's like that they're trying to find ways to convince themselves, even with hard data, that things aren't happening that are clear as well, you know? Mm-hmm. And there I feel like there is almost this kind of collective cover-up happening with the situation that we're in with the climate change, with the crisis right now that we're facing with the environment, really with the end of the age of oil and all the implications of this idea that development can't just continue to go forward to this infinite level and that we'll succeed it. Like, there's this kind of really inherent, almost fundamentalist belief that we can keep going. And to maintain that belief, I think you have to convince yourself of certain kinds of truths. And I saw that a lot in different ways. And in the film, I think, tried to present a few of the different ways that people talked about it. One, Jay Nagendran, who was deputy minister for the oil sands, actually says in the film that the soil will be better when the oil is removed because the oil is a contaminant. And by taking it out, it'll be better. There's all kinds of, I could probably go on for an hour of the kinds of things that people, I think, have, some of them absolutely absurd. I felt like I could have made a comedy film with the absurdity of our desire to pretend that we don't have to change.
Right.
And the truth is, we just can't avoid it, that hard truth. And how we do it, I think, is still really something that we all need to continue talking about.
So that basically this sort of government idea of how things should be done and what their thoughts about things. And you also talk about how NAFTA affects Canada and how Canada itself has really no oil plan at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, Canada has basically said, we are resources for the world. Come take it all, whatever you want.
Yeah.
And we'll get rich off of you just coming because we don't have to, that way we don't have to do anything. So how does NAFTA affect the tar sands and affect oil production in general in Canada? Because I think a lot of people don't understand that process.
Yeah, well, NAFTA and its insidious cousins, like the Security and Prosperity Partnerships and other agreements that are more secret and coming down the pipelines every day, really trade agreements that bind us to a certain kind of deals with the United States that we're giving more than, I think it's the average of the last 3 years. We're obligated under NAFTA of our natural resources. The average of the last 3 years, what we've traded to the U.S., we have to continue in that relationship without being in breach of our trade agreement. And there's a kind of absurdity to the amount that we've decided. Those, for example, in NAFTA that Canada quite willingly signed on to, Mexico said, are you crazy? Like, we're not going to do that. How could we do that? And opted out. But Canada, for whatever reason, has really become a resource colony of the United States. And I think that we don't understand ourselves as such, but that's been the relationship that we've maintained through NAFTA and now are continuing to reinforce through the Security and Prosperity Partnership, I think, also very much in line with an idea of creating a secure North America. Mm-hmm. The border goes around the entirety of North America, and that we convince the Americans that we're part of their security agenda so that we can maintain trade relationships.
And this is obviously to make certain Canadians fairly rich. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt about that.
In rich in certain ways, right?
Yeah,
I think that's the, and who's getting rich and how many people really and what percentage and what are we actually gambling away when we're doing this? I think are the bigger questions. I think wealth is really poorly considered in these scenarios, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm thinking more on the economic term of rich than you know, actually having clean water clean and, yeah. and healthy land base.
Absolutely.
That's, yeah, totally different style.
And sustainable work, even if we go to that level, you know, watching Fort McMurray be inhabited by Newfoundlanders, there's more Newfoundlanders in Fort McMurray than there are in St. John's. Fort McMurray is considered the capital of Newfoundland. It's like we fish all of the cod out of the East Coast, and then those people are left jobless, and then they end up migrating. You know, we have an internal migration, work migration pattern within our own country. Like, I mean, the healthiness is pretty questionable, even from a kind of pro-work, pro-capitalist perspective, I think.
Now, the other thing I find interesting about this whole process is that go online and you look on different websites. You can never really see, I guess what I would say, is really what's really going on in the tar sands. Because someone's put a story. Recently I saw that Syncrude's getting ready to expand much more than they had planned for, 2020. Mm-hmm. And then you'll see another one, somebody will say something else about how the shareholders are really holding BP to account. And then you'll see, you'll see all these variations of stories out there. Mm-hmm. But one, I mean, the tar sands are still cooking away. And then two, I don't, how much of it is just to feed shareholders information so that they'll stay invested in it, and how much of it is propaganda?
I mean, we're in an investment climate with something like the tar sands, right? I mean, I think that's one of the things. Where can you get the most information about what's actually going on is your financial pages of the newspaper or looking at, investment blogs and whatnot. As like that's where people are really trying to figure out who's going to expand or not expand. And for me, there's a lot of noise within all of that, but it's good to understand as such. It's like, this is an extremely expensive extraction process. There's no way in a logical world, there's no way that we would be extracting bitumen from the tar sands if we weren't facing an oil crisis. So if we agree about that and say, like, why would capitalists spend more money than they need to, something like $35 a barrel versus I think something like 7 or 8 in places like Saudi Arabia or Iraq, where oil flows more easily, if we didn't need to spend that much money, but how much and when and what's the, I think that's the thing that we're watching change all the time. It is a really sharply moving object for lots of reasons. Some of them because of the pressure that civil society is putting, some other ones that are just purely economic. But from my point of view, there's been some slowdowns recently. Some of them, I think that there's been some real wins by public pressure. And I think there's also been some scary consolidations of power where smaller businesses are being bought up and consolidated during the financial crisis. So I think it's one of those things that we kind of have to watch closely, and nobody's going to tell us the real deal because there's lots of corporate secrets in it. Nobody wants to say what their new technology is or how big their find is. And so it is going to be an elusive question and continuing to be, I think.
In your opinion, how scary is it that China's involved now? Given some of your African experience.
Yeah. I mean, I think that what's scary from a local perspective about China being involved is that it really ensures the North Corridor pipeline, which means that we're going to look at not only a pipeline crossing through Lubicon territory, unceded Lubicon territory, and into many territories in northern BC that are with pipelines that could have breakages, that have all the implications of what that means, but also tanker traffic opening up even more on the west coast of this country, which I think is a huge concern for so many reasons. I think China's involvement and the ease at which Canada is allowing China's involvement to come on board when that's kind of what we have to face is really scary. I think, there's huge global players here. For China to get involved, to me, is one more affirmation about how close to the end of oil we are and how seriously we have to take that, like at all levels, and also maybe celebrate it in a sense. And we can't go to that the last the bottom of the barrel, in my opinion, and survive this. You know, the Earth will probably survive. Will humans? Probably not.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, if China's is coming in here, I think it's going to mean some serious problems for us. But I think in Canada, like we're already facing some pretty serious problems if we think that our government is in any way going to be able to protect us after signing NAFTA and the agreements they have with the United States. I think we've really got to get back to a local level of resistance at the places in which these projects cross our backyards and cross into our territory, and support the people, you know, who it crosses into theirs.
What groups that you've run into, do you think that, you know, people that are listening to this and they're saying, well, how can I get involved? What can I do to basically stop this tar sands? What process, who are the people I can talk to and get involved with?
One of the things that I often say is, like, I feel like there's so much diverse kinds of action that needs to happen, mm-hmm. and that people need to find out where they feel comfortable in acting. But the fundamental line is to take some kind of action in your life. And in the H2 Oil website, so H2OilDoc.com, I put a list of quite a number of different kinds of groups that I think are all doing really great work. And you can kind of peruse that and see what you think. But okay. But from my perspective, really, like, you know, one of the groups I really love to support and is the Indigenous Environmental Network. I think they're mm-hmm. doing amazing work that really brings environmental issues to an environmental justice perspective, that we don't forget the social, that we don't forget how people's lives are being affected, and also that Indigenous people have really been leading this for a long time, and that there's lots of ways that non-Indigenous people can act in solidarity with Indigenous people's struggles. And I think that's really, really one of the most fundamental things we can do. And if you feel uncomfortable, learn about it, go on their website and try and figure out a little bit what that can mean, and don't be afraid. This is a struggle that we're facing together. But at the same time, it's like, bring it back to where you live. If the tar sands is something that provokes you and makes you angry, how does it affect the community in which you live? And try to connect the dots, because there is really a spider-like kind of tentacles going out all over all over the continent. And I think at every point, those are areas that we can connect resistance movements. They're not only places that people are going to be affected, but they're also communities in which we can collaborate, and we can feel like there's some small actions that you can do at the local level. So I try to keep little points of that as I learn them on the website, but I also encourage people to take advantage on their local levels. And then just in terms of keeping informed, the media co-op like the Dominion is an excellent resource to check out. And there's lots of great groups that are doing lots of actions locally here in Canada as well. But I think we have to really be careful. There's a lot of environmental greenwashing going on as well. And I think we have to be wary of false solutions. We have to be wary of capitalists kind of trying to resell us through carbon offsetting schemes, through trading mechanisms that they're telling us are going to save the planet. This is the most important question of our time, and we can't be fooled. You know, we all have to be as smart as we can, and also realize that the people who have got us into this mess are not going to be the ones that get us out. Follow your own logic and follow your own, I think, sense of justice, and hook in with people like the Indigenous Environmental Network, the Dominion Rainforest Action Network, and look at some of the links on my site, and I hope that will help you find where your voice is.
I was in Chapters, I think, just after the new year, and looking through different books, I was looking for a specific book on environmentalism, and came across this book that, it's, you know, it's got to be about 200 pages or more, and on how green the tar sands are.
Oh, yeah, right. No, I think I know exactly the one you're talking about.
Yeah, I just, it floored me. I couldn't believe
it. It's like, this is the green solution or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, talk about the ultimate greenwash.
Oh, it's unbelievable, you know? And again, I think we have to see, and it's good to remember that, like, fundamentalism takes many forms.
Yes.
And there is a fundamental capitalism as well, you know, where it's like, this has got to be the right way.
Yeah.
We're just going to figure out how it is, and greening the tar sands is about as absurd of a thing as you can imagine.
So pick two numbers between 1 and 10.
Okay, I'll pick 2 and 7.
Do you have friends who tell you not to be so negative about this culture, and how does that make you feel?
Yeah, I definitely do. Although less and less the older I get, and now it used to make me feel really bad.
Yeah. And has that changed because your friends have changed, or has that changed because the mentality of your friends have changed?
I think it's changed because some of my friends have changed, mm-hmm. and the mentality of some of my friends have changed. And yeah, on another hand, I think some of my friends' mentality has changed, but I also think that I have changed.
Right.
And that I mix my, like, that I have a better sense of who's who and mm-hmm. how they feel about different things and how to talk to them about it. Because I think a lot of people, for example, like a fundamental question, like, are we going to run out of water? People care about it,
right.
But they don't always want to come at it in the same way.
Right.
And it's also like listening and being open enough to hear who I'm talking to, or at least I feel like I'm getting better at that than maybe I was when I was a bit younger. But it used to upset me quite a lot, and I think now I maybe with age I'm starting to understand and accept people's reactions more, and also trying to be more open to ways that we can communicate.
Number 7 is, how do you tell in any given situation how much of what you perceive and experience is real and how much is your own projection?
How do I tell?
Yeah.
That's a good question. I would say that, I have no idea. That's a hard question. I put it against the world, you know? I think we have to trust our gut as much as our brain, you know,
right.
Like we have to trust our body as mm-hmm. much as our mind, because I think our mind is where a lot of the projection sits. And I think our body actually often knows better it knows better because it's communicating with not only the other people in the room, but the other forces around us, all kinds of them, animal and physical, that are around. And I guess all you can really do, I think you can never entirely escape your own paradigm, and I don't think we should ever want to. I think we should just want to be as transparent about where we come from and where we meet another as we can. But mm-hmm. I guess that would be, I would try and trust my body first.
Well, there we go.
maybe pass Derek Jensen's test. I don't know.
Well, I know. There's no judgment. There's no judgment
there's
on
no
the answer.
Fail. I know.
Yeah,
in Derek Jensen's class, there's no pass or fail.
Yeah, it's just here's a question, and what does it make you think? What does it make you feel? Yeah, it's really quite good. And actually, just so you know, we are having DGR, the Deep Green Resistance, is happening in
right.
Edmonton this at the end of
May.
This month. So it's we're excited
Amazing.
About that.
The end of this month, the end of March?
Yeah, 26th to 28th.
Okay.
Yeah, so.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. I will be literally on a plane towards South Africa at exactly the same time.
Oh, really? Wow.
Going and hopefully going to do some videos on the resistance that they're doing there towards the World Cup that's about to happen.
Oh, that's very interesting.
In South Africa, yeah.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I'm glad to bring that up because I know there's been a lot of, the media went out of the way to really ignore a lot of the protests against the Olympics. And,
absolutely.
And I'm sure they'll go even as much against, with the World Cup. And what I also find interesting is that the G8 are meeting on the last weekend of all the playoffs for the World Cup. Like there'll be another week, like there'll be a big, there's a whole bunch of playoffs during that weekend, and then there's a week off and then the final. And they're
right.
meeting that week during all those playoffs. And I'm like,
wow,
how come that?
I think that'll be a really interesting, it is funny that, sports can be drug of the nation in mm-hmm. a sense, and
yeah.
as we saw upscaling of activities in Afghanistan with the war machine spinning its ugly face or
right.
whatnot, like while the Olympics were going on and people getting pushed out of the the downtown Lower East Side in Vancouver
right.
and whatnot, while everyone is sort of like blissfully smiling in front of their television sets, and I'm sure that the World Cup will be no different at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's maybe far away in South Africa, but people are getting massively pushed out of their homes, out of many people I know that live in shack settlements and stuff are getting forcibly removed, but to nowhere.
Right.
And then, you know, like, yeah, and the GA meets at the same time. And yeah, you got to wonder what channel is everyone going to be tuning into when police are battering people on the streets of Toronto.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Yeah.
So, yeah. But we're really happy that in this country, anyways, we've got like a pretty vibrant bunch of media cops springing up all around the country.
Yeah.
The Vancouver media cop was excellent during the Olympics, yeah. And there's a Toronto media cop that is emerging that looks like will also really be a great site of inspiration and information during the G8. So,
yeah.
So I'm looking forward to participating in that and tuning in as well. So nice to talk to you, and hopefully we'll cross paths again.
Yeah, I hope so too.
In the resistance movement.
Yes, for sure.
Okay.
Okay, great. Thanks, Jen. Okay, bye.
Okay, bye.
I saw you fill your glass with melted glaciers. Heard you laugh as the last time I died. Told you the salmon would never forgive you. Asked you how much death till you were satisfied. You drank your glaciers and ignored my plea. Clenching your Bible and your toppled tree. Spewing off words of power and greed. Listening to no one and nothing that pleads. I told many others of your power and wealth. How nothing fazed you, the death that you dealt. They wrote letters and drafted petitions to sign. And still trees were falling. And animals crying. You bottled those glaciers and sold below cost. Trolls bought the bargain and thought not a loss. Petitions were recycled, the activists spread. And I kept trying to save a culture that was already dead. One night I realized as commercials flashed, life can never matter in a place run by cash. I packed up my bags, made a few calls, but now was the time for this culture to fall. Drove to the house where the glacier drinker dwelt, dammed up his door and bottled his wealth. I bought up the chainsaws and lit them alight. It was about time I thought I did something right. It's about time I did something right.
And that was Realization by Angela Zibaro, performed by the Filthy Politicians. It is amazing how destructive the tar sands are. I hope people understand that from what Shannon said today and McDonald said on an earlier podcast. Its poison is spreading far and wide across North America and even further. Today I saw a column on the tar sands and actually a critique of the documentary Dirty Oil done by the deputy editor of Spiked, who titled the piece, What's Wrong with Exploiting Nature? He would probably have no problem exploiting anything the dominant culture defined as a lesser life form. In his critique of the documentary, the last two lines of his column read, and I quote, "The film also suggests that it is somehow our individual greed which, by creating demand for this dirty oil, is screwing up the planet. There is nothing wrong with wanting to be better off. The whole world should enjoy the standard living of the average American. Cheap, reliable energy is absolutely necessary for that. Alberta's oil boom is set to continue for many years to come." Unquote. This is the illusion we are up against. This is the same illusion that cut down the last tree on Easter Island. Taking us out is Bombs with Empty Noise. Have a good night, folks, and remember, the resistance needs you.
Yeah.